Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a really fascinating and honestly kind of humbling look at where human biology basically slams into extreme physics.
Yeah, we're diving into environmental emergencies.
Exactly. Those medical conditions that pop up when the world outside our skin pushes the body way past its limits.
And it's a huge topic. I mean, it covers everything from the really obvious threats like blistering heat and freezing cold,
right,
to the sort of unique dangers you get from high altitude, deep water pressure, even, you know, bugs and snakes.
The local fauna.
So the goal for us, and really for you listening, is figuring out how to recognize that really complicated physiological battle when it happens in unusual settings.
Like at a big concert, or maybe an endurance race, or just a hike that didn't go as planned.
Exactly. And the sources we looked at are super clear that the body doesn't break down equally for everyone.
No. They kept highlighting how vulnerabilities really compound the risk.
Mm.
Things like pre-existing conditions, being very young or very old.
Dehydration's a big one.
Huge. And even the medications people take, they're often like the silent partners in these kinds of catastrophes.
So our mission today is to really get a handle on the body's incredibly fine-tuned balance, what we call homeostasis, and, you know, what actually happens when the environment pushes it so hard that the whole system starts to fail.
And we're starting with the core, right? The body's furnace, temperature regulation.
Yeah, let's unpack the mechanics. How do we keep that internal engine running at just the right temperature?
Yeah.
So when we talk about homeostasis, we're really talking about this delicate balance of supply and demand for pretty much everything the body needs.
Makes sense.
For temperature, the control tower is basically our central thermostat, deep in the brain, the anterior hypothalamus. It uses these specialized neurons, thermosensitive ones, to keep our core body temperature, or CBT, right around 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
And when that system fails, well, that's when the definition of an emergency kicks in.
Yeah.
We're looking at hyperthermia, when that core body temp drops, starting around 95 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right.
And hyperthermia, when it climbs too high, starting at 100.4 Fahrenheit.
And something that's really important for you to remember, especially in the field, is that getting an accurate temperature reading can be tough.
Oh, yeah. How so?
Well, think about it. Oral temperature. It can be all over the place if someone's breathing really heavily or if they've been drinking cold water or something.
Ah, okay.
That's why, you know, medical teams working in extreme settings often rely on rectal or maybe tympanic, like in the ear measurements. They just reflect the core temperature much more reliably.
Gotcha. So the body is always generating heat, like a furnace. How much heat are we talking about just, you know, sitting still?
That's what we call the basal metabolic rate, or BMR. Think of it as the heat energy you produce just at rest, kind of the pilot light that's always on.
Okay.
For an average person, maybe 70 kilos, it's around 70 kilocalories per hour. Now, that rate's influenced by things like age, hormones, sex, stress.
But the big one is exercise.
Oh, absolutely. The critical takeaway is that any kind of physical exertion just dramatically ramps up that metabolic rate and therefore internal heat production. Massively.
And then the body has to dump that extra heat. Thermolysis, I think the source calls it.
Exactly, thermolysis. And that process relies on a couple of key things. Expanding the blood vessels near the skin, that's vasodilation.
Letting the heat out.
Right, and sweating. We learned that there are basically four ways we lose heat. Radiation, conduction, convection. That's where wind chill becomes a big factor.
Yeah, makes sense.
And crucially, evaporation.
And this is where it gets really interesting, hitting that kind of critical insight from the sources.
Yeah, this is key. Evaporation is the only way the human body can actually dissipate heat when the outside air temperature gets close to or even goes above body temperature.
So if it's 100 degrees outside,
you can't radiate heat away effectively. You have to rely completely on turning liquid sweat into, well, gaseous vapor to cool down.
And that cooling ability just stops cold, according to the sources, at a relative humidity of just 75%.
Stops entirely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That single data point really explains why heat illness becomes so deadly so fast in humid climates. If your sweat's just dripping off you, you're not cooling.
You're not cooling at all. That's inadequate thermolysis, and that's where the danger really starts.
And we have to talk about risk factors here.
Definitely. Older people are particularly vulnerable. They naturally perspire less. They acclimatize much slower. Often their sense of thirst is diminished. And critically, they might be on common medications like diuretics or beta blockers that actually mess with the body's ability to sweat or vasodilate properly.
And on the other end, infants and young kids, and also groups doing heavy exercise, like athletes or military recruits, they're also high risk.
Because their proportional metabolic heat production is just so incredibly high compared to their body size or their cooling capacity.
So when you're assessing someone who's, clearly suffering in the heat, we need to quickly figure out how bad it is, differentiate the stages.
Absolutely. Heat exhaustion is, let's say, the milder form. It's mainly about volume depletion, losing fluids, and heat stress. They'll be sweating profusely, often pale, clammy skin, maybe nauseous, dizzy.
Okay, feels awful, but maybe not immediately life-threatening.
Compared to heat stroke, yes, heat stroke is the real killer. It's a life-threatening neurological and systemic failure. The two absolute defining characteristics you have to look for are the elevated core temperature and the altered mental status.
Both. You need both.
You absolutely must have both. If someone is talking to you clearly, answering questions appropriately, they don't have heat stroke, even if they're really hot.
And there's a distinction within heat stroke itself, right? Something about how they look.
Yes, and this is a really important point that often gets missed. Classic heat stroke, the kind you might see in an elderly person during a heat wave, often results in dry, flushed, hot skin. Why? Because their sweating mechanism probably failed hours ago. But, and this is critical exertional heat stroke, the kind you see in that marathon runner or the soldier doing drills, they might still be pale and actively sweating buckets.
Really? Even with heat stroke?
Yes, because their metabolic engine is still running full blast, generating enormous heat. So the takeaway is you absolutely cannot wait for the victim to be dry before suspecting and treating for heat stroke if they have that altered mental status and high temp.
Wow. Okay. Good point. Now let's pivot hard to the other extreme, cold.
Right, thermogenesis. This is the body's kind of frantic effort to create heat when it's losing it too fast. That same hypothalamic center cranks up muscle tone and most obviously starts shivering.
And hypothermia officially starts below 95 degrees Fahrenheit core temp. But there's a point where shivering stops, right? That sounds bad.
That is a terrible sign. Shivering usually stops somewhere around 91 degrees Fahrenheit. It means the body's basically run out of fuel for that desperate heat-generating effort. It's exhausted its reserves.
And alcohol, such a huge risk factor here.
Massive. It impairs judgment, obviously, so people might not realize how cold they are or take proper precautions. But physiologically, it's a double whammy.
How so? What?
It promotes vasodilation, widening blood vessels in the skin, which paradoxically makes you feel warm, but actually increases heat loss to the environment. And it actively impairs the body's ability to shiver effectively.
So you feel warmer while actually getting colder faster.
Exactly. It's incredibly dangerous.
How do you spot early hypothermia? The sources had a mnemonic.
The umbles. It's actually pretty memorable and useful. You look for stumbles like an uncoordinated walk,
Okay.
mumbles slurred speech, fumbles losing fine motor skills, dropping things, and grumbles a change in their mood, becoming irritable or confused.
Stumbles, mumbles, fumbles, grumbles. Got it.
Yeah.
And beyond just being cold all over, there are localized injuries.
Right, frostbite. That's when the actual tissue freezes. Superficial frostbite might make the skin look waxy, white, maybe a bit pliable.
Indeed.
Deep frostbite is much worse. The tissue becomes hard, cold, completely without sensation. It's essentially dead or dying tissue. Very serious.
And then there was trench foot. That one surprised me because it doesn't need freezing temperatures.
No, it doesn't. Trench foot can happen at temperatures as high as 60 degrees Fahrenheit. It's all about prolonged exposure to cool, wet conditions. The constant dampness impairs circulation and damages the tissue.
So keeping feet dry is paramount, even if it's not actually freezing out.
Absolutely critical. Prevention is everything with trench foot.
Okay, so if temperature extremes are a battle against, thermodynamics, let's move to an environment where the battle is against pure physics.
The deep blue sea. Diving.
Yeah.
In diving, the environment literally forces physics onto our bodies. We
Oops.
start at one atmosphere absolute, one ATA. That's just sea level pressure.
Right.
That pressure increases by another full atmosphere, another one ATA, for every 33 feet of salt water we go down.
And our bodies are mostly water, so the tissues handle that pressure okay.
Our liquid-rich tissues, yeah, they're largely incompressible. But our gas-filled organs, lungs, sinuses, middle ears, they're compressible. and that's where all the danger lies.
This is governed by Boyle's law, right? Volume is inversely proportional to pressure.
That's the one. As pressure increases on descent, the volume of gas in those spaces shrinks. That can cause barotrauma, like that painful middle ear squeeze divers sometimes get if they can't equalize.
But the real lethal potential comes on the way back up, on ascent.
Absolutely. Because that compressed gas has to expand again as the pressure decreases, and it expands rapidly.
Catastrophically, even.
It can be. Think of the gas in your lungs like, I don't know, a balloon that got squeezed way down at 100 feet. The sources really emphasize that the most dangerous pressure change, the biggest relative volume change, happens closest to the surface.
This is just coming up the last few feet.
Exactly. If a diver ascends rapidly, maybe panics and holds their breath for just a few feet near the surface, that rapidly expanding gas can literally rupture the tiny air sacs in the lungs, the alveolar.
Like a champagne cork popping inside your chest, one source said.
That's a good analogy. That rupture is called pulmonary overpressurization syndrome, or POPS. And the consequence is devastating. It can inject gas bubbles directly into the arterial bloodstream.
Arterial gas embolism, AGE.
Yes. And those bubbles travel immediately, often straight to the brain. They cause stroke-like symptoms, paralysis, seizures, loss of consciousness, even death within seconds to minutes of surfacing.
And the implication for treatment is?
Immediate transport to a hyperbaric chamber. Time is critical. Time is brain, just like with a stroke. You need to recompress them to shrink those bubbles.
Okay, so that's about gas expanding. What about gas dissolving? That's Henry's law.
Right. Different problem, different gas law. Henry's law says that the amount of gas that dissolves in a liquid is directly proportional to the partial pressure of that gas above the liquid.
And since air is mostly nitrogen?
About 79% nitrogen. As you go deeper, the partial pressure of nitrogen increases, so more and more nitrogen dissolves into your body tissues. It saturates your tissues.
Which is fine while you're down there.
Generally fine while you're at depth. The problem is on ascent. If you come up too quickly, the pressure drops too fast, and that dissolved nitrogen comes out of solution, forming bubbles within the tissues themselves.
Like opening a shaken soda bottle.
Exactly like that. Those bubbles can block blood flow, cause inflammation, pain. That's decompression sickness, DCS, or what divers call the bends.
And the risk factors here are significant, too.
Very. Multiple dives close together, especially deep ones. Being overweight, dehydrated, even just being fatigued all increase your DCS risk.
And the warning about flying really stuck with me. You shouldn't fly within 12 to 14 hours after diving.
Correct. Because the lower pressure inside an airplane cabin at altitude effectively mimics continuing your ascent. It can be enough to trigger DCS if you've got residual nitrogen still dissolved.
Wow. And DCS comes in different flavors.
Yeah, it's generally categorized into type 1, which is milder, maybe involves joint pain, the bends, skin rashes, or lymphatic swelling. And type 2, which is much more serious, affecting the nervous system, cardiovascular system, or lungs. Neurological DCS can be devastating.
Okay. And while those are both related to coming up, there's one that happens at depth. Nitrogen narcosis.
Right. This one's about breathing compressed nitrogen itself. At depth, especially when the partial pressure of nitrogen gets up around, say, 3.2 ATA or higher, the nitrogen acts almost like an anesthetic gas.
Like getting drunk underwater.
That's often how it's described. It causes altered mental status, sometimes euphoria, impaired judgment, inappropriate behavior. Divers sometimes call it rapture of the deep.
How do you manage that?
Primarily by limiting depth. Or divers can use special gas mixes like nitrox, which has a lower percentage of nitrogen and a higher percentage of oxygen, to reduce the narcotic effect at a given depth. Controlled ascent also helps clear it.
Okay. And one last pressure thing related to holding your breath, hypoxic blackout.
Yeah, this is really tragic when it happens. It's often seen in breath hold divers like free divers or spearfishers, especially those who hyperventilate extensively before they go down.
Why does hyperventilating cause a problem?
Because hyperventilating blows off a lot of carbon dioxide, CO2 is the primary trigger for our urge to breathe. So by hyperventilating, you suppress that urge, allowing you to stay down longer.
Right.
But as you ascend from depth, the surrounding water pressure drops rapidly. This causes the partial pressure of oxygen in your lungs and blood to plummet very quickly right as you're nearing the surface. You don't feel the urge to breathe because your CO2 is still low, but your oxygen drops below the level needed to maintain consciousness.
And you black out just inches from the surface.
Exactly, inches from safety. It's incredibly dangerous.
Okay, let's shift gears dramatically again. From the crushing pressure of the deep to the thin air at high altitude.
Right. Terrestrial elevation. We're talking generally above 5,000 feet, but clinically significant illness, the stuff we really worry about, usually starts when people ascend rapidly above 8,000 feet.
And the problem is hypobaric hypoxia. Low pressure, low oxygen.
That's the core issue. Low atmospheric pressure means lower partial pressure of oxygen, so there's just less oxygen available with each breath.
And the body's first reaction is?
Panic, essentially. It starts hyperventilating, trying to grab every available oxygen molecule.
Like the breath hold diver, but for a different reason.
Sort of, yeah. But this sustained hyperventilation quickly throws your blood chemistry out of whack. First, you blow off too much CO2, making the blood too alkaline respiratory alkalosis. Then the kidneys try to compensate, leading towards metabolic acidosis. This whole chemical imbalance, combined with the low oxygen itself, makes blood vessels leaky, especially in the brain and lungs.
Leading to the main altitude syndromes. The most common is acute mountain sickness, AMS.
Yeah, AMS is super common. Headache is the hallmark symptom, often with fatigue, dizziness, maybe nausea, difficulty sleeping. Feels like a bad hangover, basically.
Okay, then it can get worse. High altitude pulmonary edema, HAPE.
Yes, HAPE is fluid in the lungs at altitude. This is critical. The key symptom is shortness of breath at rest, maybe a persistent cough, sometimes frothy sputum, and profound weakness.
And the cause is different from regular heart failure.
Very different, and this is crucial for treatment. HAPE is caused by marked uneven constriction vasospasm of the pulmonary arteries in response to hypoxia. This forces fluid out of the vessels into the air sacs. It is not caused by overall fluid volume overload.
Meaning standard treatments like diuretics don't work?
They don't work and can actually be dangerous by causing dehydration. You have to treat the underlying vasospasm, often with drugs like nephetamine that relax those pulmonary arteries alongside oxygen and desent.
And the most dangerous one, high-altitude cerebral edema, HACE, fluid in the brain.
The most dangerous, yes. HACE is defined by any change in mental status, confusion, drowsiness, irrational behavior, or ataxia, which is loss of coordination, like stumbling or being unable to walk a straight line, occurring in someone with AMS.
And the treatment for HACE is?
Simple and absolute. Oxygen, if available, and mandatory immediate descent. There's no waiting it out. Get them down. Now,
any medications?
Dexamethasone, a powerful steroid, is critical for HACE. Give it immediately to reduce brain swelling. For AMS or helping with acclimatization in general, acetazolamide can be very helpful.
What if you can't descend? Like stuck on a mountainside in a storm?
That's where portable hyperbaric chambers come in. They're basically inflatable bags you put the person inside and pressurize with the pump. It effectively simulates descending several thousand feet, buying crucial time, essential kit for high-altitude expeditions.
Okay, moving to a completely different kind of extreme energy event, lightning strike.
Yeah, this is pretty unique physics. We're talking a massive unidirectional flow of electricity, millions of volts.
Yeah.
But the duration is incredibly short, like milliseconds, and often the current actually flows over the victim's skin called flashover rather than passing directly through the core of the body.
But it still causes major problems.
Oh, yeah. That massive electrical discharge acts like a giant depolarizing shock to the entire body. It instantly stops the heart, causes a systole, and it also paralyzes the respiratory center in the brain, causing immediate respiratory arrest.
Both stop, heart and breathing.
Both stop simultaneously. But here's the major clinical paradox, the thing that's absolutely crucial for anyone responding. The heart muscle itself is often undamaged and has its own inherent pacemaker activity. So frequently, the heart will spontaneously restart a normal rhythm on its own after the shock passes.
But the breathing doesn't.
But the respiratory center in the brain often stays paralyzed for longer. So the heart might be beating again, but the person isn't breathing.
Meaning they'll die from lack of oxygen anyway if no one breathes for them.
Exactly. They'll suffer a secondary hypoxic cardiac arrest if that apnea, the lack of breathing, persists. This leads to what emergency responders call reverse triage in a mass casualty lightning strike.
Reverse triage.
Yeah. Normally in triage, you prioritize those with signs of life. But with lightning, you have to focus resuscitation efforts first on those who appear dead, the ones who aren't breathing, and have no pulse initially, because they might just need basic ventilation to get oxygen back to that spontaneously restarted heart and allow the respiratory center to recover. It's totally counterintuitive, but can save lives.
Wow. That's something else. Any visual clues?
Sometimes, yeah. You might see this unique temporary skin marking. It looks kind of like a reddish fern-like pattern on the skin. It's called a Lichtenberg figure. Fades fairly quickly, usually.
Okay. Last category of hazards, envenomation, bites and stings.
Right. And it might surprise you, but the single most frequent cause of death from venomous creatures, at least in the U.S., isn't actually snakes or spiders.
No. What is it?
It's anaphylactic shock, a severe allergic reaction primarily from Hymenoptera stings. That's bees, wasps, hornets, and fire ants.
Oh, the allergy itself makes sense. But the actual venoms from snakes and spiders are pretty nasty, too.
Oh, absolutely. They deliver highly specialized toxins. In the U.S., you've got basically two main snake groups to worry about. First, the coral snakes, they're elapids. Their venom is primarily a potent neurotoxin.
Affects the nerves.
Exactly. It causes things like numbness, tingling, paresthesias. But the real danger is it can affect the nerves controlling breathing, leading to respiratory paralysis and difficulty breathing.
Okay. And the other group, pit vipers.
Right. Pit vipers include rattlesnakes, copperheads, cottonmouths. They're crotalins. Their venom is totally different. It contains enzymes designed to break down tissue, hemolytic and proteolytic enzymes.
So it causes local damage.
Massive local damage. Significant swelling, bruising, tissue destruction around the bite site. And critically, it often messes with blood clotting, causing systemic bleeding problems, what we call coagulopathies.
And the source has had a chilling safety fact about dead snakes.
Yeah. Never handle a supposedly dead venomous snake, especially the head. Their bite reflex can persist for some time, even after death, and they can still inject venom. Seriously, just stay away.
Good advice. Okay, spiders. Black widow.
Black widow venom is also primarily a neurotoxin, like the coral snakes, but it works differently. You get rapid onset of intense pain, often localized at first, but then it can spread. The hallmark is severe muscle cramping and spasms.
Spasms, like everywhere.
Can be quite diffuse, yeah. Sometimes it's so bad it can mimic the rigid abdomen you see with serious surgical emergencies.
Right.
And if those spasms affect the diaphragm, the main breathing muscle, it can potentially cause respiratory difficulty.
Oh, ouch. And scorpions. Mostly not too dangerous in the U.S. except one.
Exactly. The bark scorpion, found mainly in the Southwest, it's the only U.S. scorpion whose sting is considered potentially life-threatening to humans. Its venom is also neurotoxic, but it has this really unique mechanism. It causes continuous, uncontrolled firing of nerve sodium channels. It's like jamming the accelerator pedal down on the nerves. This leads to this whole constellation of symptoms called autonomic excitation, think excessive sweating, drooling, hypersalivation, maybe rapid, uncontrolled eye movements called nystagmus, and extreme restlessness or agitation. Very uncomfortable, potentially dangerous.
Okay. And just a quick final note on ticks. The bite itself isn't the main issue.
Right. Tick bites themselves are rarely dangerous. The real concern is that ticks are vectors carriers for a bunch of diseases like Lyme disease, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, etc.
So removal technique is key.
Absolutely crucial, according to the sources. Use fine-tipped tweezers or forceps. Grasp the tick as close to the skin surface as possible, right where its mouth parts enter. Then pull upward with steady, even pressure. Don't twist or jerk the tick. You might leave the mouth parts embedded.
And no folklore remedies.
Definitely not. Critically, never use things like petroleum jelly, nail polish, or heat like a match. The idea is that might suffocate the tick, but it can also cause the tick to regurgitate its gut contents, potentially full of infectious agents, right back into the bite wound. Just a steady upward pull.
Got it. Wow. This whole deep dive has really spanned the full chaotic spectrum of environmental threats, hasn't it?
It really has. From the crushing external pressure of the deep sea to the thin air of the mountains, the extremes of temperature, and even the, you know, invisible toxicity delivered by tiny creatures.
And every single event we covered, heat, pressure, altitude, venom, and it all represents a breakdown point, right? Where the environment just overwhelmed the body's central, incredibly fragile process of maintaining balance, homeostasis.
It really highlights just how finely tuned the human machine actually is, and maybe how small the margin for error really is in some situations. Huh. Whether it's that, you know, critical 75% humidity cutoff point for evaporative cooling we talked about,
right,
or the tiny pressure increase near the surface that can rupture an alveolus, these life-sustaining processes can be just catastrophically disrupted by factors that might seem pretty benign if you don't know what's happening.
We spend a lot of time detailing these really acute, dramatic emergencies, the lightning strikes, the HACE, the heat stroke. But, you know, considering the sources also mentioned these more subtle risks.
Yeah, like trench foot happening in relatively mild 60-degree wet weather.
Right, or just the general increased susceptibility for people taking common everyday medications like diuretics or beta blockers. It makes you wonder, What seemingly moderate, maybe even everyday environmental stressor could be unknowingly compromising your own long-term physiological resilience?
That's a really interesting question. Something to definitely think about as you go about your day.